This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, it's back to school. Of course, we have youngsters that have gotten their backpacks, their school supplies together. They're in classes now. They're dealing with problems with school, class schedules, bus schedules, after school activities and all. So people can get stressed out. Young people in particular, they're prone to that with the start of a new school year. And there's always a concern about now teenage suicide. And that's why we are turning to Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman with some new information for us. Tammy, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Well, remind us about the seriousness of suicide among teenagers in Indiana, and tell us about some new required training that is helping people deal with it.
Thank you for taking on this difficult topic, right? It's something that as parents and engaged community members that is tough to discuss, but teenage suicide is unfortunately a very big issue in Indiana. It's actually the second leading cause of death for our young people between the ages of 15 and 24. And for those younger, our little ones, 5 to 14, it's actually the fourth leading cause of death. And so it's something that we need to take very seriously. And unfortunately, Indiana also ranks higher than some of our neighbors. And in response to this, the General Assembly has taken some action to make sure that particularly our educators have more youth suicide prevention training.
I understand that they've, in the last two sessions of the General Assembly, that they've taken up the issue, and that's how we have some new required training these days. Tell us about some of the thoughts that lawmakers had when they were talking about this, even as recently as this past session.
Yes. And so, again, I think they deeply understood the fact that this is a big issue in Indiana, and they wanted to do something that kind of stepped up our responsiveness to make sure that some of our folks that have the most contact with our kids, so obviously that's educators in many cases, have the training they need, not to intervene and not to be those mental health providers or behavioral health providers that some of these kids really do need, but to be that first screen, really, to be able to identify what are some of the warning signs that children may exhibit when they're contemplating suicide, and then make sure that we can make those warm handoffs and those referrals to the people who really can jump in and provide some of that counseling and support that's needed.
Now, getting this new school year underway, all teachers and educators in grades 5 through 12 have some required training. Tell us what the training is and what that in turn the school corporations hope to be able to get out of it.
Right, certainly. So, as you said, all teachers and educators, so that's all principals, all counselors, all the folks that may be teachers' aides, are required to get 2 hours of training specific to youth suicide prevention, and that's every 3 years. But given the fact that the legislation just went into effect, they all have to get their first training this academic year. And there's been a little bit of confusion. There's some confusion around the wording, but we've talked to the Department of Education, and they verified that, yes, everyone needs to get that first 2 hours of training this academic year. And as you know, time goes quickly in the school year. And so that's something that they're looking for at all schools. And again, that's for any grades 5 through 12, so middle school and high school as well. And so there are a few trainings that the Department of Ed has identified, the trainings that they consider evidence-based and that are approved. It doesn't mean those are the only ones, but they've started with 3 listed on their website so that schools can go there and start getting that training.
Now, we mentioned here that a lot of this is going to be involving educators and teachers in the public school system, and I'm sure that private schools are probably encouraged around Indiana to join in this as well. Do we find, though, that there may be some issues that people in the Department of Child Services come across when they're working with families that have problems and they're trying to deal with issues there, that maybe that they, if they're not already trained in their own particular ways, that they can help be prepared so that they can kind of head off some of these incidents of suicide?
Well, certainly, and anyone can get this training. And again, for all of us, it's important to have some awareness and sensitivity to this issue. Anyone that comes in contact with kids, because we know that particularly in those adolescent years, in those early adolescent years, sometimes kids open up to different adults, right? So they may not say something to their mom and dad that they might say to their coach or their teacher or their youth group leader. So again, if you go, you know, the Department of Education has links to what some of those trainings are, you know, as well as some great resources. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is one of those. The Jason Foundation is another that have, again, some of those technical training aspects, but they also have some great information that parents, grandparents, or caring adults could also benefit from.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, about some new required training, legislative mandated training that has been reviewed over the last couple of years, but took effect back on June 30th for teachers and educators in grades 5 through 12 in Indiana to participate in the training hours of youth suicide awareness and prevention training. And in working with the State Department of Education, what did folks, your staff there at IYI do to help speed things along? I'm sure that the Department of Education was going by the guidance that the state legislature had passed on to them, but I'm sure they probably had questions that they felt the IYI might be able to assist them.
Certainly. One of the things that we really talked to them about and that they were happy to discuss was the idea that, and we know that the numbers, you know, we're such a data-driven group, the numbers, when you disaggregate the information, there are some kids that are at higher risk of suicide. So that we know that kids that are systems engaged, so that's either foster care or the juvenile justice system, are more likely to contemplate or attempt suicide. We know that kids that identify as LGBTQ are at a significantly higher rate of suicide, as the same holds true for Latino or Hispanic youth. In general, girls are more likely to attempt suicide, are young girls, and however, our young men are more likely, unfortunately, to die as a result of suicide because they choose different approaches and different methods. So girls are more likely to cut or take overdoses, and young men are more likely to use a handgun or a firearm or hanging. And so, again, really understanding how this manifests in different groups of kids was what we kind of added to the conversation and wanted to make sure was embedded in this policy. And we've done a couple of trainings on it. We have some more coming up at our big conference in November. And the response to that, our educators know that, right? They work with kids every day. They know the kids that are at highest risk. And they've not only they attended the training filled up immediately to capacity, they've asked for more. So, you know, it's a great thing that our state is really diving headfirst into this and saying we need to talk about it more. We need to make sure training's available for everyone so that hopefully we can prevent this. Suicide is something that's wholly preventable.
Now, Tammy, you've talked in particular here about some of the groups that seem to be more prone to have these problems. Will we break it out even further? Are we finding that there's even the same statistics are the same for urban as well as rural school districts? We have a lot of problems with the inner city young people, but do we have the same kind of problems for young people that are in small communities and in turn are involved in smaller school districts around the state?
Well, both have their challenges, right? So thank you. That's great that you brought that up. And one of the things that I wanted to highlight is that there are actually suicide prevention coalitions around our state. And so there's one in Northwest Indiana. It's called the Northwest Indiana Suicide Prevention Council as well, you know, and that they know what those specific, and they're really trained to deal with the issues in their area. And all of the names and contact information for all of those folks are available on the Department of Ed site, and we also have a link to it on IYI site. So you're right, there are sometimes different issues, but both groups, it's really a matter of feeling connected, right? And in rural areas, the challenge can be that they're far away from peers or support networks. Simultaneously, when you're in perhaps a huge school setting, those kids can feel like they don't have a niche, right, that they don't belong to a group. So it's all about that feeling connected, making sure that these young people know that there are adults, there are plenty of adults that care for them and making that connection and reaching out to them.
Well, we know that here in Northwest Indiana in particular, we have a lot of young people and a lot of school districts, of course, in our populous counties like Lake County, but out in Porter and LaPorte and in Newton and Jasper counties and Stark counties, they're out there too. The school districts aren't as big, but the problems still remain.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we've seen that whether it's a small school district, a big rural, urban, suburban, this is a pressing issue across our state. So again, I would really encourage any parents or grandparents or caring adults that are out there to reach out, one, to their schools to look, you know, we have some great resources online that are free and available to everyone, as well as to look at the Department of Ed site, because, again, they have some of these folks that really specialize in suicide prevention. One of the big challenges with teens is that as they're developing, they go through a lot of emotional roller coasters, and sometimes it's hard to tell if this is just normal teen development, you know, right? If they, as a mother of two teens, sometimes they can get a little bit of an attitude or they don't want to participate in things. And it's important that we know what signs to look for. Sometimes those are just teens being teens, and sometimes they're an indicator of something more. So again, reaching out and doing just a little bit of research, reading up on it a little bit, can really make a big difference in the lives of our kids.
Well, the shocking statistics about teen suicide in Indiana is available in the data brief that's available on the IYI.org website, and more information is available on the Indiana Youth Institute's website. And you'll also see the links there to the Department of Education's website that shows this new information and that's out now for the new training that's underway. Tammy Silverman's the president and CEO of IYI, and thank you as always for being with us. And we hope that this new required training that schools all across Indiana are going to have to go through will help bring the numbers of teen suicides down.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Chris, and thanks for caring about Indiana's kids.
Indiana officials say the vast majority of unwanted telephone calls reported by Hoosiers are scams. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith tells us that officials say that the problem with Indiana's Do Not Call list is that it wasn't designed to prevent scams.
Indiana Deputy Attorney General Marguerite Sweeney says at least 70% of unwanted phone call complaints are about scams, and that's in part why the Do Not Call list won't stop them.
Scammers are criminals. They don't care about the list. If you continue to get calls when you're on the list, you know that the calls you're getting are more likely to be scams.
Sweeney says technology has made it easier to spoof calls, make it seem like they're coming from somewhere they're not. That's partly why prosecutors can't do much about it.
Even if they had the resources, they lack the jurisdiction if the robocallers are not in the United States.
Hoosiers reported nearly 4,000 unwanted phone calls so far this year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Greenfleet Radio. And here's your host of Greenfleet Radio, Carl Lissick.
Well, good day, and thank you for joining us for another edition of Greenfleet Radio. Today, we have a very special guest. It's Mrs. Judy O'Bannon, co-producer of WFYI Public Broadcasting, Television's Communities Building Community with Judy O'Bannon. Mrs. O'Bannon, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we are just so excited to have you. And so for our listeners new to the state of Indiana, you were Indiana's first lady, correct?
That's right. A long time ago.
and that must have been quite an experience.
It was a wonderful opportunity. And the best part about it led into really the kind of work I'm doing now, traveling around the state and visiting people at sometimes really high or really low points in their lives. And they bring you in and they share that with you. What an honor. I've just met fabulous people, and I just keep doing that.
Well, we're honored to have you here today. And so, what eventually led you into this business?
Well, I think I've always been yappy. As a kid, I was always yappy, talked a lot. In Cordon, Indiana, our little town in southern Indiana, we had a cable station, and they said, you know, you can't have a cable station unless you do local programming, which used to be just put a camera out there and look at people's business cards. What a bore that is. So because we had a little stake in that, I started interviewing people. And it's just a fabulous, wonderful thing to get to do. During my time as First Lady, I did some of that, did some radio and did some television programs. But really afterwards, all of a sudden when my husband died, I had no job.
Okay.
And people would say, want to go on a trip? And I sure did. Carried a camera, and I've been producing television programs with WFYI for now about 17, 18 years.
Wow, wonderful, wonderful. And so that brings us to the program you're working on today. Tell us about that program.
Well, we are following a program on the diversity of citizenship in Indiana, finding Indiana's not just a bland place. Wonderful people from all over live here. And then thinking, where's the next step? And it's really the environment that we all live in. And so we're traveling around collecting seen stories, everything from one person who's got a little stack garden in their backyard to big outfits like hospitals that have farms on top. Why are they doing that? What are they doing? We hear a lot of discouraging things about the environment. So to be able to present positive stories is wonderful. And I'm meeting great people like you in the process.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. So tell us more about some of these wonderful people
you've
met.
They're all over the place. Mm-hmm. We've been where people are recycling everything from human waste, who are thinking about what they call a permaculture, you live forever, sustainability. They're talking about reuse of things. They're talking about limiting your use of bad stuff, doing green stuff, eating farm to table. We've met people who are zero waste, where you would think not. Piazza Produce in Indianapolis, big truck fleets that are distributing to four states, and they have zero waste.
Wow.
That's a pretty good accomplishment.
That is. That's wonderful.
And I think up here in the area, in the region, you are doing fabulous stuff, and I came and wanted to find out about
it. Well, we're glad you're here today. And so you're listening to the Green Fleet Radio. Our guest today is Mrs. Judy O'Bannon, co-producer of WFYI, Public Broadcasting Television's Communities Building Community. So as I understand it, you've been observed and that there's a spiritual or faith-based element to the motivation of these.
There really is. The consultant on this program is a environmental theologian. Mm-hmm. So many people said, what do you mean an environmental theologian? Where's the connect? Well, to me, it was pretty obvious that we're all in this together. We're a relationship with fish as well as air and the soil and other human beings. And so We've run into a lot of the programs or policies have been led by people who are with organized churches, Mennonites, Muslims, Presbyterians, and Methodists.
And they often get along.
They all get along because they're all working toward being one with this universe that we're in.
Wonderful. And so what do you hope your viewers will take away when they watch your show?
Well, I hope they start to think about themselves as part of that environment. They are connected just not with physically with, you know, my pop can. If I throw it in your yard, that means something. Mm-hmm. It means you got to make more pop cans and you got to pick it up and we produce nothing very positive. I hope they stop and think there's something I can do. I may not be rich like a big petroleum user, but I may have a little garbage can I can recycle or have a worm garden in and have a better flower garden, that everybody thinks there's a place for them and they start thinking and talking about it as mainstream sustainable life.
So how can people learn more about what you're doing across our great state?
We're putting together this program. It'll be an hour long through WFYI Public Television. We hope that it's run all over the state because this is an we're all of us in it kind of a thing.
Absolutely.
It's not just Indiana alone either. It's all of us with the universe. They'll see themselves in that and become more active in their local communities.
So, Mrs. O'Bannon, what do you want your legacy to be?
Oh, good grief, I never thought of that. I just hope they don't say that old lady was such a busybody. She poked into everybody's. I love the idea of everything being intertwined, spiritual and material, time and place. We are like a tapestry, and we work best when we're all working together in a positive, cooperative way.
Wonderful. And as we come to the end of our program, any closing thoughts?
Well, I'm glad to be part of your voice into this northern Indiana focus. Oftentimes, you know, we think that people pay only attention to people right around them. So Indianapolis, which is a lot of our population state, think if you're right down on the old national road, you're probably in the loop. We forget about southern and northern Indiana, and believe me, northern and southern Indiana knows it often. So I'm glad that we're talking in a broad base like you are, out to get the word out that no matter where you live, you're part of the same ecosystem.
Absolutely.
And you better get with it.
Again, thank you for being here today, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to our very special guest, Ms. Judy O'Bannon, co-producer of the WFYI Public Broadcasting Television's Communities Building Community with Judy O'Bannon. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us, and remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you.
Greenfleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, and you can hear Greenfleet Radio every Wednesday right here on Lake Regionally Speaking, and podcasts of Greenfleet Radio are available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking. NIPSCO is a company in the region that believes in diversity and also believes in the professional advancement of women. Dee Holler, who is NIPSCO's director of a new business in Indiana, explains to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson how the company follows up on those beliefs.
Tell us why NIPSCO has gotten involved with the Lakeshore Public Media Women's Conference.
Well, NIPSCO is committed to inclusion and diversity not only because it is the right thing to do, it's certainly a business imperative, but we feel that we owe it to our customers, our employees, and our stakeholders to provide an environment that takes into account everyone's perspective. And so the Lakeshore Professional Women's Conference was just a natural partnership for us, particularly because we do have a number of employee resource groups, one of them devoted to women. It's called Developing and Advancing Women at NiSource. DAWN is the acronym for that. And so we started being involved through that connection, that effort. And it's really the only event of its kind in Northwest Indiana. It's certainly, you can go to Chicago, you can go to Indianapolis and get something similar, but not of the quality that the Lakeshore event is. So we're thrilled to be a sponsor. We started out being a lower level sponsor and we've grown to be the presenting sponsor and glad to do it. A lot of our employees, mostly women, attend.
Well, we certainly do appreciate that. Thank you so much for your support. So tell me about DAWN.
DAWN was one of our first efforts into the employee resource group at NiSource. NiSource is the corporate owner of NIPSCO. We have operating companies across the footprint of the central Midwest to the east coast of the country. And we started the endeavor really to just bring a focus to it. We have two very powerful women who happen to be executives with NiSource. One is our president and CEO of NIPSCO, which is Violet Sisteveras, and our other chief legal officer, who's Carrie Heitman. Got together and said, you know, we'd like to put a spotlight on women and how we can develop and retain talented women. And they started a series of events that were summits for women. And one of the asks after the first summit was that we start an employee resource group dedicated to women. And so we put a planning committee together and we formed what was one of our first resource groups. Since then, we have resource groups that are dedicated to veterans, to Gen Xers, to the LGBTQ environment. So we have, I think, seven of them now. You know, across different interest groups, open to all, obviously, but very happy with the way that our company's been growing in the last few years as far as diversity and inclusion.
So what comes out of the resource groups? Is there a certain goal in mind, just to make people understand each other better? Is it like to support each other, or is it a charitable thing?
All of the above. Our mission is to develop and advance women and to retain those women. Part of it is recruitment of talented women. And it's a group made up of mostly women, but we have a number of male employees that are joined as well. And it's really to start the conversations, to get to know one another and their issues, to make sure we're talking across any type of divide there might be. There's a lot of development opportunities that we offer. We have guest speakers come in and talk about their journey and other related topics, how to, you know, progress your career and a lot of different things. We do have a charitable piece to it. We participate in our charity of choice, which is a NIPSCO function that we do every year where the employees actually choose a charity that we're going to support on an annual basis. And we raise between $150,000 and $200,000 for the specific charity. This year, shout out, because it's for autism. So it's to benefit those who have autistic children or folks in their household. And so that's our charity of choice this year. We're just kicking it off. So
anything else come to mind about any positives that have come out of your resource groups?
You know, our promotion of women has increased, and I don't have the statistics in front of me, but we do have them, that the promotion of women at our organization has increased significantly. And I think a lot of it is just putting a spotlight on the issue. We're a, you know, public utility company. We're an energy company, not typically what you think of as cutting edge and as far as, you know, looking at women or, you know, targeted areas of opportunity. So for us, it was a big focus and a big reward to get those numbers moving in the right direction.
So what do you have to say to the women who are attending the Lakeshore Public Media Professional Women's Conference?
You know, talk to everybody. It's a wonderful opportunity to get to know folks in our region that you wouldn't necessarily be in the same room or building with. So do get out of your comfort zone a little bit. Try not to stick with your little clique every time you go from speaker to speaker, or, you know, or at lunch or during the network opportunities. Try to make, you know, one new friend, because folks are typically very open, you know, to talking to folks they don't know, and learn something about, you know, another group, another company, perhaps employer in our area. It's all about building a network, whether it's for support or advancement or just knowledge building. So it's really a wonderful opportunity to get together with folks that you may not have the, you know, the chance to meet.
So you've been to the conference before, it sounds
every
like.
Year, yeah. Every year, yes. Oh,
okay,
so absolutely.
Yeah,
haven't missed one.
Good, good. What's your favorite thing about the conference?
You know, I like the speakers. I tend to gravitate towards the more professional speakers rather than the awareness-type focused speakers, but I just really like to hear the different perspectives. Even though a lot of the topics are things that, you know, if you've been around for a while, and I have, you know, you've heard before, I always get something new from them. So they're just really dynamic folks that come and have really different mindset often than you might. So just listen and, you know, be open. And that's the part I like. It's a great lunch.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about the food.
You
got
to
include the food.
You can't miss the food, right.
Exactly. Well, anything else you want to add? Is there anything that you want people to know about your company that is not widely known?
Yeah, you know, our company sometimes, particularly if your lights are out, are not necessarily the most popular folks. But But, you know, NIPSCO is committed to providing energy safely and reliably and at a great value to our customers. And part of that is, you know, creating a culture for, again, our customers, our stakeholders, our employees, that allows everyone's perspective to be heard and everybody's voice to be listened to. And that includes our customers, again, our employees. So, you know, we are really working very hard every day for our customers. It's our main focus. And, you know, it's a great place to work, a great place to visit. And we do a lot of good work in the community. And we provide livelihood for a lot of folks. It's like the 6 degrees of separation thing. It's very hard to speak to somebody who doesn't have some family member or friend whose livelihood doesn't depend on NIPSCO. And so we feel like we really do touch a lot of folks' lives in our community, not just from providing service.
Can't be an easy thing. It's a 24/7 endeavor, providing electric,
yeah,
you know, your services to everybody. And with storms and everything, it's got to be a challenge, but glad you're there.
Someone's got to do it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Some days are better than others, that's for sure.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate you your support of the Lakeshore Public Media Professional Women's Conference and the conversation here today.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
That's Dee Holler, who is NIPSCO's Director of a New Business in Indiana. She was talking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about the company's belief in diversity and the professional advancement of women. The Lakeshore Professional Women's Conference, presented by NIPSCO, is coming up on Thursday, September 20th from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m., and it'll be held at the Blue Chip Hotel and Casino in Michigan City. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie now joins us in the studio to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I was told that whenever I board my dog, taking an item of my own personal clothing for him to have in his boarding crate is comforting for him when he's in a strange place. I always wondered if this is an old wives' tale. Is there any science behind it, or is it really true? Signed, Marilyn from Dyer.
Dear Marilyn, the scent of a woman, or in this case, a woman human. I know that when I go away, I find my woman human scent comforting because it reminds me of safety, security, and a big dog dish piled high with canine appropriate goodies. One of my housemates suffers from a case of acute separation anxiety. When he's left behind, even in the safety of our own home, he feels vulnerable and tries frantically to get to our humans outside by chewing the door frame into pieces or digging underneath the door. This behavior has caused much yelling and wringing of our woman-human's hands. Once, when we came home from a short once when we came home from a short shopping trip to Valparaiso, he had collected together items that all of my house humans had touched or worn. He actually surrounded himself with a variety of things bearing their scent. In fact, he even collected the remote control from the television area along with some funky old pink slippers, socks, and a t-shirt with Go Bears printed on it. He felt safe. In his head, this was a good way of letting a potential house intruder know that they had better stay away. The familiar scent of a dog's owner lingers like perfume in a dog's brain, according to U.S. scientists. Gregory Burns of Emory University. Okay. The familiar scent of a dog owner's dog. Words. The familiar scent of a dog's owner lingers like perfume in a dog's brain, according to U.S. scientist Gregory Burns of Emory University. According to scientist Gregory Burns of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, he says, when humans smell the perfume or cologne of someone they love, they may have an immediate emotional reaction that's not necessarily cognitive. Our experiment may be showing the same process in dogs. Dogs are social creatures with a very strong desire to be with others like themselves or humans. If they are deprived of the social contact they need, there may be barking and howling and panic resulting in the sudden need to do their business, leaving a mess wherever they are. Dogs show preferences for different people and for different dogs. Their ability to process scent is 40 times better than ours, so their world is defined by the use of their nose. Humans use their hands and eyes to explore the world, so we are very different in a zen sort of way. A dog's vision is not as detailed as ours, so they recognize different objects by smell and shape rather than by detail and texture. So yes, Marilyn, it is a very good idea to bring an object with a scent for your dog when he is away from home. However, be careful whose scent is on the object. Make sure it's not the scent of that cat or a competitive dog. Marilyn, in your case, it should always be the scent of a woman, human, and that would be you. Signed, your friend in fur, Ollie. And remember, love is a four-letter word.
You can send your pet questions to Ollie at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. I'm Chris Nolte, and we thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today. Of course, tomorrow's Thursday. Here on the program, we have Reporters Roundtable Thursday with reporters from local media talking about the stories that they've had out there online as well as in print. We'll have Joseph Pete, who's the business reporter with the Times of Northwest Indiana and the fellow who covers what's happening in the city of Gary the most for the Post-Tribune. Greg Tejeda will be joining us as well, too. We hope you'll be joining us for Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday tomorrow.